This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And, of course, the same time we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. So however you're listening, welcome to our show. And today we're going to start our show talking with Lily Schoenig. She is an instigator, I guess, of the Committee for a Nonpartisan President. Thank you for joining us today, Lily.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself before we start talking about this process you want to get going.
Well, I won't go too much into my history. I grew up in Park Rapids, Minnesota. I grew up in a lower class. There were five of us. I grew up on welfare. I've always been passionate about public service and helping others because sort of a pay it forward mentality. I had my daughter, Michelle, when I was 16. So, you know, I started out the parenting thing pretty young. And then I managed to go back to college later in life. I got my undergrad in political science from North Dakota State University in 2011, minor in history. And then I went to UND School of Law and got my JD in 2014.
So now you're an attorney practicing in the public sphere.
I am, yes.
Now, tell us about the Committee for a Nonpartisan President. Why did you want to get this going?
Well, I don't know if you've ever had an experience similar to what I've had, but I had a concept that hit me like a ton of bricks in the beginning of August, and it's been burning a hole in my brain ever since. And if I don't get it out there somehow, I think I'm going to explode. There's just a major calling that I feel public service is so important to me. I need to do something with this concept or I don't know what will happen.
Well, with this synthesis in your background of your upbringing, the legal education, interest in political science and history, what problems do you see with the current way we elect a president?
Well, the problems with the current way that we elect a president is that all three branches of government are basically centered around getting a president in office that shares either a Democrat or Republican. There is no emphasis on passing laws anymore from Congress, which is Congress's job. Right now, Congress focuses on doing everything to get a president in power that shares that party's D or R. And so the perfect example is you can look at President Obama with health care and you can look at President Trump with the wall. The party that's out of office does everything to obstruct anything the other party does while they're in power, because that way they can say that party got nothing done. Let's put let's give the Republican or the Democrat a try. So obstructionist politics is the center to everything, and nothing is getting done.
But a part of this, the reason we call it partisan is because it's a way to assemble support, I guess, in a formal way, and to have troops, if you will, in the political sense, go out there and sort of help you fight the battle. So how would this differ? You'd be a nonpartisan president, but you would need a party of people, a group of people to elect you.
Certainly. So it's very important that people understand I'm not proposing a new party. I'm proposing that the person who is elected president be restricted from being partisan. You see it all the time in state politics. There are certain offices where you are precluded from participating in partisanship.
Well, in North Dakota, the Department of Public Instruction.
yeah. And much of the bureaucracy, the bureaucracy makes up about 90% of the federal government employees are part of the executive branch. They can't function properly if they have to know that every 4 years or 8 years, there's going to be an overhaul in their leadership. And but much of the bureaucracy, they don't think about whether or not there's a Republican or Democrat in order for them to do their jobs. You know, many states have, including North Dakota, elect judges. Technically, the judges are not supposed to be partisan. They're not supposed to go to rallies and you know, come out in support of political candidates or
anything
like that.
But we have an assumption that even the person who's in charge of the Department of Public Instruction has a political affiliation.
Well, and of course, everybody's going to have their own personal preferences on whether or not they vote Democrat or Republican, and we can't restrict that from happening. But what we can do is say, Republican Party, Democrat Party, you can no longer contribute money to the presidential candidate. You can no longer nominate a candidate for president. Focus on the legislative branch where partisanship matters and is appropriate, the lawmaking branch. Let's not have a partisan president, the executive branch, because it doesn't work, because the executive is supposed to be enforcing the laws and, you know, providing for the security of the country. In the age of all these cyber terrorism risks that we have, having a president that has a certain affiliation towards one political branch is beyond dangerous. And also, it's the level of hate between the two parties is so exaggerated nowadays that I've had people say to me that are intelligent people that we're inevitably moving towards civil war. And of course, that breaks my heart.
Well, haven't issues become more politicized and polarized because of the rise of social media? They sort of an easy way to make an argument and then run away from it.
Well, it's actually really, really important component. The way that political mobilization works, the way that these parties stay in control is by mobilizing people to go out and vote. And we know that the way that you do that is by getting people talking about an issue that is important to a person. It's actually not that simple, though. A lot of times, the parties exaggerate an issue that isn't even really partisan and then adopt it as their own. And then they terrify people with straw man arguments and other memes to get people to get out and vote. Now, this happened for years. This is the strategy of political parties to mobilize.
Yeah, there have been bumper stickers. There have been buttons. There have been commercials.
Our blood has been boiling, you know, whenever we were out on the highway for a long time. But all the political science studies said we're not as polarized as we believe. You know, we're being told that we're this polarized. Mm. That all changed turned on a dime when we had the social media. Now we really legitimately are being pulled apart by the two parties. And social media, of course, is a big part of it.
We're also being, I think, torn apart by outside operators, people with ulterior motives, maybe even people in another country.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I have to be really, really careful presenting this idea that I don't wear my personal opinions on my sleeve, which is going to be very difficult for me, because I think we have to focus on what everyone can agree on. If we're going to be able to get, and if we are going to be able to preserve our republic, I think it wasn't George Washington. I can't remember who said it, but Benjamin Franklin, sorry, said, okay, you have your republic now if you can keep it.
Mm-hmm.
He was specifically talking about factions when he made that statement. Factions was synonymous with political parties. And
there was an argument, there was a debate among the founding fathers about political parties and whether or not the president should be a nonpartisan representative.
Well, unfortunately, they didn't separate the concept of the viability and advisability of political parties among the three branches of government. The founding fathers believed that they were going to potentially be the cause of the demise of the republic, but they saw them as an unfortunately necessary evil. What I wish that they would have done is realize that the three branches of government function in very different ways, and what may be appropriate for the legislative branch, that is the lawmaking branch, isn't necessarily appropriate for the executive branch. We know that it's not appropriate for the judicial branch. You know, there's this fiction that when you appoint a judge to the federal branch, there's not going to be a political motivation behind it. We all know that that's not
true. That's clearly politically motivated. The fact that the Senate is turning out a lot of federal judges right now is proof of that.
Yeah, but also the president is supposed to be – if the president were required to be nonpartisan, then it would be a lot less of a fiction. So I think that what needs to happen is – The office of the presidency should be much more of a, okay, Democrats and Republicans, you're not getting anything done. So I'm going to be above all this fray and do what needs to be done. But that can't happen if you have partisanship in front of patriotism. So I always say we have to put patriotism above party, and the president needs to be above all of that.
Well, I think you would be hard-pressed to find somebody running for political office who didn't say, I put patriotism in front of my party. But that's lip service, obviously. We're talking about a public statement. How is this sort of not throwing gasoline on the populist fire, if you will? I mean, parties sort of help restrain that, the demagoguery that can go run amok if you present an argument unfairly.
That's an important question, and that's why let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that partisanship plays a very important role, especially when we have this feeling that we can't make a difference as individuals. And so that's why we join parties in the first place. We find something that we care about and we join those parties. But again, that there's a place and a time for that. The president needs to be above that. But the lawmakers, that dialectic is important among the lawmakers. That sort of in law, we call it the adversarial approach. You have one side that argues one way. You have another side that argues another way. And through the conflict, you can get to the truth. But that works when you've got a body of 100 or a body of 400, you know, however many there are in the House of Representatives. It doesn't work when you have one person. And another good way of analyzing this is, let's keep in mind the role of the vice president, which is, of course, part of the executive branch. One of the vice president's most important roles is to be what you call a tiebreaker.
Well, in the past, we've even had presidents and vice presidents who weren't the same party.
Yes.
That's a long time ago.
Well, but how do you break a tie when you're a – when you were placed there by the Republicans or when you were placed there by the Democrats, you don't break a tie.
You're virtually another member of the party in the voting bloc.
This would cut at the knees the way that our system has evolved, where it's not about passing laws anymore. It's about putting your party in office at the executive branch. Well, if that's no longer an option, then the lawmakers can focus on actually engaging in that dialectic approach, that adversarial approach, without having to fight whether or not they're going to be able to get their guy in the office in 4 years, because that won't even be an option anymore. And it'll also bring it much more to the state level, which is where it belongs. The executive should be at the top, making sure that everybody is getting their job done. That's the enforcement. I mean, I work in law enforcement, so I know how this works. You know, I am part of the executive branch of government. So that's how law enforcement works. You can't do that if you are – all you're concerned about is getting reelected and making sure that the people who funded you last time will fund you next time.
Now, our current president, Donald Trump, is not a traditional Republican. At least two of the candidates running against him representing the Democratic interests, Bernie Sanders and now Michael Bloomberg, are not traditional Democrats. So aren't they essentially kind of crossing those partisan lines?
Well, it's one thing to cross the partisan lines. It's another thing to not even have the partisanship affiliation at all. That way you can focus on the issues. You know, our parties in this country have evolved tremendously, but they have remained at their core what the founding fathers called factions. Factions and political parties were synonymous. Those words meant the same thing to them. So I think everyone – so we focus on what we can agree upon in order to affect change. What can Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives all agree upon? Well, we can agree that the level of hate is at an all-time high and we are divided more than ever. We can agree that political parties have done a lot of damage that the founding fathers have warned against, no matter which side you're on. And we can agree that something needs to be changed. I think we can all see that their constitution has unfortunately become broken, and so we agree that there needs to be a constitutional amendment, but nobody can agree on what needs to be amended.
Well, and that opens up another can of worms, too, because once you start talking about changing the Constitution, well, why not make this change, too?
This is the fundamental problem with unfortunately, the way that our Constitution was designed. Everybody has an opinion, and everybody's opinion diverges in some way. So what we need to do is make it simple and make it something that everyone can agree on. This is a simple change, and it would basically require the president to be nonpartisan. And all the amendments have, or most of the amendments have language, you know, requiring the legislature to pass laws accordingly to implement the amendment. This would be no exception. But by having this as an amendment, it would remove the straitjacket of some of the analysis of the First Amendment.
Now, I don't have a political science background, but I've been talking to politicians for a long time. And it occurs to me that if you were to look at the various voting groups out there, especially for a presidential election, the biggest group would be the undecided or unaffiliated voters. The next biggest would be, and it would be smaller, would be the Democrats, and then behind them the Republicans. So in order to be elected president, you actually have to cross, you have to get people to vote for you that aren't in your party.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, this is the old paradigm, and what I'm proposing is a new paradigm, and this is not the first country that has nonpartisanship required for various offices. There's offices all over the country that are at their core nonpartisan, and there are certain things that a person who holds that office cannot do, restricting that person's First Amendment rights, which of course requires a constitutional amendment. But it's not unheard of, but we would have to change the way that we think of things. But that's what we need to do right now in this country in order to get back on track. This is a tweak that I think, that I know would make all the difference in the world. But we have to stop thinking about our candidates as being members of political parties. That was before they ran for office. When they decided to run for office, they had to give that up.
Well, Lily Schoeneck, you're the committee for a nonpartisan president. Is it a committee of one yet? Or, I mean, you filed with the state. How would you describe the organization at this stage of the game?
So I filed with the state today. Then I will seek out a 501c4. That's with the federal, the IRS. I am planning on a event in the very first business meeting to be held, a date to be determined, about a month away. And at that meeting, whoever ends up signing up to be a member between now and then, you can sign up at nonpartisanpresident.org, or you can email me at board@nonpartisanpresident.org. Whoever signs up to be a member will be able to vote. At that time, I'll have proposed bylaws. And then we're going to be having at least monthly business meetings to follow. The organization is registered with the state of North Dakota, but anyone can become a member. I'm also going to be looking for volunteers to have business meetings that'll run contemporaneously with the one in North Dakota so that people can vote all over the country.
Well, let's get to that. I mean, is this something that is emerging in other states too, or is it just unique to North Dakota and you right now?
Well, right now it's just in North Dakota, but I will be seeking out volunteers that are willing to have business meetings in other states. They'll all be voting members of the committee for a nonpartisan president, but we will be having, I'm sure, chapters in other states as well, and we'll have to register with the Secretary of State in other states
as well. So this is one small step, to paraphrase Neil Armstrong, that you hope grows. Obviously, in this election cycle, it's not going to be real impactful, but mm-hmm. it has to start somewhere. Is that what this is?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mostly it's just about getting the idea out of my brain so it doesn't destroy me from within. I need to get it out there because it's been it's been something that I've needed to just get outside of me and try to make something happen.
Now, there's a slight bit of irony here in terms of the effect that social media has had on our political process. It has gotten people pretty fired up, you could say, because probably the most effective way to get this idea out is via social media.
Indeed. Indeed, yes. So I will be creating a Facebook page, and it will probably be called Committee for a Nonpartisan President. I haven't put that together yet. The first step was to get registered with the Secretary of State. But that's actually the website is going, and the Facebook page will follow shortly thereafter. I've got one of the members already who is in Arizona. He's working diligently on the website, and he's just a genius when it comes to social media. So it's really helpful, and he's been very supportive.
Well, we'll see where this goes. Thanks for sharing your ideas with us and our listeners. Lily Shonek is with the committee. She is the Committee for a Nonpartisan President, and her rallying cry, her slogan is Patriotism Before Party. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
As our guest Lily reminded us, we are in the presidential season. Well, Mark Trahant has been in the news business covering this kind of stuff for a long time. He's been a reporter. He's taught journalism. He's been an editor. And he's currently the editor of Indian Country Today, where he writes and delivers commentaries on issues in the news. And today, Mark looks at the accelerating presidential campaign and the potential for a decision much later than usual in the process of selecting a candidate for the Democratic Party.
We have heard from Iowa and New Hampshire, two states that are less representative of the country as a whole. And beginning now, a lot more voters will weigh in. Nevada kicks off the next round with a caucus this weekend, then South Carolina, and then more than 30 contests in March. In fact, some two-thirds of the Democratic delegates will be allocated before the end of the month. And Donald J. Trump is cruising to the Republican primaries in states where there is even a contest. There is little question that the GOP will renominate the president, so much so that many states have just canceled their primary vote. In order to win the nomination, a Democrat must earn 1,991 delegates for the first ballot and 2,375 on the second. This is where it gets interesting. Most of the primary elections are proportional, so a candidate may win the state, but only earn a few more delegates than the other candidate. There is also a bonus if a candidate tops 50%, and with this many candidates, that's not likely. There are a couple of scenarios worth considering. First, Senator Bernie Sanders could run away with it all. He has an army of volunteers in every state and is now the front runner. There are establishment Democrats who are uncomfortable with a Sanders nomination. They fear the word Democratic Socialist will turn off voters and put more states in play for President Trump. But there is no one moderate that people agree on, and candidates are not likely to quit the race just on this point. On the other hand, Sanders is bringing new voters into the process. One exit poll showed that in New Hampshire, Sanders had more voters from young people than all of the other candidates combined. The case for Sanders is that he is bringing about generational change, and that this is not an ordinary election. The second scenario is that a lot of people will win states. Perhaps it will be former Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former Mayor Michael Bloomberg, or Tom Steyer. If that happens, there is a chance no candidate gets the magic number to win the nomination. If not, then it will be up to the convention to come up with a candidate. The last time that happened was 1960 with John F. Kennedy. Indian Country will get a voice in the days ahead. Some of the caucuses in Nevada will be in tribal communities. And Indian Country Today has invited candidates to Arizona for a conversation with Native journalists. Plus, there will be a national debate in Arizona in March. A little more than a month from now, we may have a clearer picture about the 2020 election. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, Prairie Public's Tim Wollenzien joins us to talk about innovative projects in education services. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. From a commercial clam dealer's permit to a driver's license, the state has a lot of fees on the books, and the state auditor's office has just completed a performance audit of those fees. The study had been suggested by Mandan Senator Dwight Cook, who chairs the Senate Finance and Taxation Committee. State Auditor Josh Gallion says once he heard about the study, he was all for it.
We focus a lot on the expenditure side, which to me is only one half of the coin. But you can't spend money unless you collect it. And so as I started asking questions about, okay, well, where are all these fees at? Who knows this information? Nobody had it.
Gallion says it was a lot of work.
2,022 and a half audit hours.
Gallion says he plans to have a listing of the fees posted on the auditor's website.
You'll be able to sort it. So if you want to see by agency, you can sort them by alphabetical order. If you want to see which ones are paid by the public, you can filter those and see, okay, here are the ones that the people are being charged for licenses or various fees.
The push to legalize recreational marijuana continues at the state capitol in St. Paul. Wyla Fete with the Minnesotans for Responsible Marijuana Legislation says legislation can bolster safety by removing the black market. She says drug dealers don't check IDs, but you move something into a regulated market and you stand to lose your license as a retailer or distributor if you're selling to underage individuals. Minnesota House leaders and Governor Wall support recreational marijuana, but Senate Republican Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says he strongly opposes legalization. So far, 11 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized it. And Minnesota lawmakers are taking aim at a common nuisance, robocalls. State DFL Representative Zach Stevenson gives utility regulators more power to investigate and punish when false caller ID numbers are used to mask solicitation calls. It would also require telecommunications companies, to make wider use of call blocking technology known as spam calls. GOP Senator Rich Dryham has another measure which would increase the civil penalties the state attorney general could seek for illegal robocalls.
I think everybody is frustrated with the number of robocalls. You're almost afraid to answer the phone anymore. And I think anything we can do to help reverse that, I think, is a positive step. I think it's a bipartisan issue.
The telecom industry says lawmakers should give federal regulations time to work. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by someone we've had in our studio many times now. Tim Wollenzien is the Education Services Manager for Prairie Public, and he joins us to update us on a number of projects you've been working on. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me.
Describe the mission of your unit at Prairie Public just to begin with.
Well, we serve the mission of the greater Prairie Public Station, and that's to inform, to educate, and to inspire. And our piece of it is to work with the education angle, which, you know, is something that is part of what all of us do here at Prairie Public, is that we're educating our audience. But we work primarily with teachers, with students, and with communities that are associated with schools, whether that's kids, parents, families, and communities.
Well, when Prairie Public first went on the air, and it was one station in Fargo at one time, it was a TV camera and a studio, and then it maybe could go outside the studio on occasion with lots of muss and fuss. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, so much of it can be done online.
Yes.
So let's talk about the weekly web chat that Darcy Markegaard started, right?
Yes. And the weekly web chat is a continuing program that is going on now, where these weekly web chats, they're still recorded. We still do some live web chats for English and math teachers. But Darcy collected all of these web chats that she's done over the last couple of years on topics that range from technology in your classroom to social-emotional learning to working with particular technology to reading resources and so on. And they're recorded and edited as she's done them live. And then they're uploaded to the Prairie Public YouTube page and are part of this weekly web chat class. And so teachers can go online from anywhere they want, whether it's their phone or their computer at school or home or wherever, and they can access these web chats. And if they're part of the class, they can get credit for it. And so they submit, question responses or question or essays or whatever to the questions in this class program, and then they get university credit, professional development credit.
Well, that is very useful because teachers are always looking for those CEUs. And, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, is there an expense involved here? Obviously, if they go to a university or a college or a community college or whatever, that there's expense getting there and might be a course expense too.
Right. If they register for the university credit, they have a credit, the cost of the credit. And for most of the universities that we work with, and we work with four of them in North Dakota at the present, the credits are around $50 a piece.
Well, that's less than if you're on campus.
Much less than if you're on campus. And so then the expense is your time and, investment that you make of scheduling it.
And you've got teachers doing this now.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be a teacher to go to Prairie Public's YouTube page.
That's correct. And we've got there's 24 teachers that have registered for this semester that are participating in the class, which I'm facilitating at this point. And in fact, they keep adding. And I think this is a wonderful opportunity for teachers because you can do it on your own time, on your own schedule, and you've got the whole semester to get the 15 hours in. And So I got another request this morning from a teacher that wants to add into the course for this semester.
So you can improve the weekly web chat with this interaction, obviously.
Yes.
And the need for, improving teaching skills is pretty well been there since teachers were invented.
Yeah.
And you've got issues like collaborative learning and classroom mm-hmm. discipline, stuff that teachers really – it helps them to – connect on this.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're teaching them. Darcy has a bunch of them up there. Mm-hmm. And how is it supported? It doesn't cost a whole lot to do this, but it does cost something. It's time and other things.
It's time and resources for us. When Darcy began this, we still are part of the Teacher Community Program grant. And so her time and salary and everything was paid by the grant. Now, we've made an investment in some technology, and she's made an investment in time to work with these teachers that are actually involved in the web chats that are recorded, and then time with our folks here at Prairie Public to make sure that things are hosted correctly on YouTube platform and that are accessible to teachers. But right now, the expenses are really human in time, right? Uh-huh. I mean, it takes us time to facilitate the class.
You know, it's not necessarily a novel idea because the internet has been on for a while. Web chats have been available for a while. But it strikes me that this kind of structure where people can get online credit might be something that would be transferable to other states, other districts, other places.
Yes. And that's the intent of the Teacher Community Program is for us to develop a model that can be shared with other stations. And in fact, at this moment, we're working on a summary project to showcase this weekly web chat that will be produced by PBS and then distributed to other stations to use to perhaps replicate this model.
Let's move on to another subject because a while back we had you in the studio here to talk about the Molly of Denali Rural Education Initiative mm-hmm. grant. Mm-hmm. Briefly remind us of what that is and where are we now with that?
Well, the Rural Education Initiative was a grant that was awarded to five PBS stations in rural areas of the country. And so we were one that was selected. There's one in Upper New York. There's one in Appalachia, one in Alaska, and one in rural Nevada. And we are to test the development of materials that can be used for family interaction around the new program for kids on PBS Kids Molly of Denali, which was set in rural Alaska that features native children, native families, and the native culture and values and so on from Alaska. And our job here with this was to somehow come up with a process that we could find materials that families could use to interact around this show, around the program, that would be unique and that would be relevant to a rural family in a rural community. And so through this almost a year now that we've been on this grant, we're finally now to the final engagement where we've developed all of these different prototypes and we've tested them on small markets. And now we are actually working in a community to test the family game pack, which is a box that, like, you would get a board game with all the pieces and cards and stuff that the families have, and they're using it with their kids every week, and then they're helping us by completing a survey, and the kids bring those back to school, and then this goes on for 4 weeks. There's different games every week, and then at the end of the time, we do a final, like, a focus group. We want to find out, did these work? Were they appropriate for you? Was it the right level for your kids and all that? And then we have a celebration that we're calling a culminating event for all the families that participate in that particular community to come together and celebrate being part of this really unique project.
So Molly of Denali is a PBS animated program.
Yes.
What age groups are we talking about here?
It's targeted for kids ages 4 through 8, and the vehicle for the distribution of the content in the program has to do with informational literacy. And so, you know, that Molly is a blogger. She likes to read. You know, they go to the library. I mean, those are all parts of her mother is a mail courier. She flies the bush plane to take the mail around to Alaska. And so, you know, so there's a lot about how do we share our information? How do we get our information there?
And how many families are in this pilot project?
The one that we are doing, there are 86 families that we're working with in New Rockford Cheyenne School. And we put out a call for proposals from all over the area to do this final engagement. And we selected, out of all of the applicants, we selected New Rockford Cheyenne because of just the demographics of their community, the location, and because of the great interest that the teachers have shown towards working with us on this project. And so we're working with preschool, kindergarten, first grade, and second grade teachers. There are 7 teachers involved in the elementary school in New Rockford, and there are about 120 kids from 86 family units.
Wow. So these 86 families are intentionally taking the time to interact with their young children educationally in this project.
Yes.
So how much time in a week typically do you think they're spending doing this?
I think the recommended time was at least an hour a week to spend with your family to get through the games for that week. And there are 3 or 4 different games that are rolled out each week. And then there's a research team that's been contracted to work with this project that then has developed checklists and surveys for the parents and families to complete as well. And then the teachers kind of are the gatekeepers with this. So, you know, we've set them up with all of the resources and incentive gifts for the kids and all kinds of stuff. And then the teachers are the ones that are making sure that the kids get the stuff, that they're turning in their surveys and they're checking off all these things for their students. And then the teachers, since this was a grant that was awarded to this particular school, then the teachers are receiving honoraria to be part of this, because this is over and above their daily work.
And in the meantime, and ultimately, there's an evaluation of the success of this project.
Yes.
And the idea would be that it goes from a pilot project to something much bigger.
Correct. And, you know, that it's actually being tested in a real live, authentic community with real live human subjects in a family unit in a small town in rural America. And so what's going to happen then is they'll take all of this data that they get from all the different five stations that are part of this project, and they're all doing their final engagement a little bit differently. And they'll take all that data and put it together, and they'll go, this game worked, this game didn't work, this one was too easy, this one was too hard, the parents didn't like it, they didn't understand, whatever. And they'll take all of that and put it together and hopefully then create an actual family game pack that will be reproducible and then at some point in the future distributed for mass distribution to wherever they decide would be the best way to get it to people.
Then somewhat like the weekly web chat, this has the potential to be something much bigger and to actually transform the way families interact with the educational system.
That's the point, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So maybe in another decade or so, it'll be commonplace for families in California, Florida, or whatever, mm-hmm. to be working with their young children, and perhaps this model gets older too. I mean, it's the curriculum that makes a difference here.
Exactly.
The other complication, though, is that you will have families who simply don't participate because some families are less functional than others.
Right.
So maybe the next step is finding a way to still accommodate those students in that interactive environment mm-hmm. without the mm-hmm. involvement of mom and dad necessarily.
Right. But, you know, they've set it up so that there's support from the teachers, there's support uh-huh. from the school, and hopefully, you know, that's an incentive enough.
The Ignite Learning Summit is coming up in late summer, and you've been working on this for a while. Again, give us the background here and what's the goal?
All right. This is a teacher professional development event that we have been doing with our colleagues at Lakes Country Service Co-op in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And we are putting together an opportunity for teachers to come in and have a day of professional learning. And this is the second year that we've done the Ignite Learning Summit in this sort of format, where we do a day-long event there. Last year we brought in some speakers, and then we had local teachers that did breakout sessions. This year we're changing it up a little bit where we're not bringing in any big names, but that we're offering incentives to teachers to come and share with their colleagues. And so we're inviting teachers now to apply to be one of the Spark speakers or the Spark presenters at this day-long conference. And they can submit a video, a little Flipgrid video, which is an app that a lot of teachers are using now, uh-huh. And submit that as part of the application here for this and give us their elevator speech about what is it that they can share. I mean, all teachers are experts on something. And a lot of teachers, never get a chance to share that with their peers.
So is this a day-long meeting that has a lot of breakout sessions? How does it work?
Yes. Yep. So there will be a almost like the TED Talks at the beginning.
Okay.
And where there will be, you know, four or five teachers that will give their, you know, their spiel about something. And then we're going to have a number of breakouts during the day where teachers can go in and get a little more in-depth on particular areas. And then it's a one day thing, but then there's a second add on day where we'll do a little bit more, deep learning, about, how to apply what it is that you've learned or discovered in day one, and to put that into an action plan that you can take back to your school. The second day is a little bit more flexible.
How many teachers do you hope to attend?
We're hoping to get at least 60 to 75 teachers there this year. We did this last year and had, if I recall, maybe in the 30s, but we've got a lot longer lead time on it this year. And I meet by Zoom with the planning team in Fergus Falls, you know, every couple of weeks, and they've got the staff to put together the materials that go out to teachers. They've got the connections with all of the schools in their region. And so the word gets out to teachers in all the schools in the Fergus Falls Lakes Country region.
So this Ignite Learning Summit is something that's transportable to other communities, other areas, and I assume that you're looking at, you know, where does Prairie Public go and where can you go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how can this work in other places?
So if you're looking for something that's useful for continuing education credit, this is one of those opportunities as well?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And there is a small fee for them to register for this conference for that for the day that goes to Lakes Country. But a lot of this project is supported by the Minnesota Legacy Grant that we have, funding that we have.
Their lottery money.
Yeah. And that's and so part of the initiative is to support education. And so we've partnered with these Ed Service Co-ops in Minnesota, Lakes Country, and also Northwest Service Co-op in Thief River Falls, because those are the two co-ops that are, you know, in our service area in Minnesota.
Now, you also offer Spark Grants.
Yes.
Talk about this.
Okay. Spark Grants, and this, again, came out of the teacher community program. It's become a really popular thing where teachers that have participated in any of these opportunities that I've been talking about, whether it's Ignite Summit, whether it's the web chats, whether it's any kind of ed camps or any kind of interaction that teachers have had with something through Prairie Public, they can apply for a Spark Grant, and a Spark Grant is an opportunity for a teacher to get up to $1,500 to purchase something that they can use in their classroom or with their students or to somehow enhance the work that they're doing in their schools or their classrooms, whether it's buying some iPads for your class, whether it's outfitting your class with a library, whether it's setting up a healthy snack cupboard, which is one that I just approved last week, and I can't announce it yet until I get verification from them. But they fill out this simple application, and then the principals arrange for the award to be given and send us pictures and all that. And then, you know, we're doing a couple of them a month now.
So you're encouraging innovation.
Indeed.
It strikes me that this is Prairie Public's Education Services Department's R&D program. This is like research and development that's ongoing and changing perhaps the way things are done.
It is. Yeah, indeed.
So what's next? Is there something on the drawing board?
Well, we're evaluating right now the staffing in our department and some of our strategic goals as we move forward into the future. A couple of these grants are ending or will end soon. And so, you know, we'll be without support for those things, but we'll still have our team here to do these projects. And so we're thinking about a future production of podcasting, of opportunities for students to tell their story, for kids to tell their story.
You recently had a bunch of kids from West Fargo in here to learn about podcasting.
Yeah. Kids are really eager to learn that, and teachers are interested in teaching it. And there are a lot of communities and a lot of places in our region where people are just they don't have an outlet to tell their stories. And so, you know, there's so much media that bombards us on a daily basis, and that's not just us, it's kids too. And for us to be part of helping them to do that in a responsible and a healthy way is one of our goals here as part of the mission of our department.
Tim Wolenzien is the Prairie Public Education Services Manager. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Theater NDSU, in collaboration with NDSU's Challey School of Music, is proud to present Into the Woods. For one weekend only, February 27th through the 29th at 7:30 p.m. and March 2nd at 2 p.m. in Festival Concert Hall. The musical reimagines classic fairy tales and reveals a moral for all eras. More information is available at 701-231-7969.
This is Decoded 8 Book for February 18th. In the early 1900s, Mark Claw and Abraham Lincoln Erlinger were among the biggest names in entertainment. Based in New York City, they produced Broadway shows and owned a chain of theaters. They also took shows on the road to major cities across the country. Ben-Hur was the pinnacle of their work. It was called the greatest spectacle of the 20th century. The production almost didn't happen. Author Lew Wallace doubted it would translate well to the stage. He couldn't imagine how the pageant of the chariot race could possibly be portrayed in the confines of a stage. He also worried that audiences would not like Jesus being portrayed by an actor. But Clough and Erlinger convinced Wallace they could do it. They said Jesus would be represented by a beam of light, and they had a plan for pulling off the chariot race. After Wallace watched the premiere, the author asked in amazement, "My God, did I set all this in motion?" The staging of Ben-Hur was a massive undertaking. It required a cast of hundreds and elaborate sets. Camels and horses were trained to run on treadmills as a cyclorama rotated the scenery in the background. The show opened on Broadway in 1899 and went on to run in various locations for 21 years. It's estimated that over 20 million people saw the show. North Dakotans were thrilled to learn that the extravaganza was coming to Fargo, the biggest show there ever. It was originally scheduled for 3 days, but there was great interest in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota, creating an extraordinary demand for tickets, far more than could be accommodated in just 3 shows. The managers of the Fargo Opera House pleaded with Clough and Erlinger to add more shows. On this date in 1909, the producers announced that Ben-Hur would be extended to cover the entire week, 7 evening shows and 2 matinees. The shows were completely sold out. 1 ticket request came from Chicago. After only 1 performance, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican pronounced the show the greatest scene on modern stage. It was a rare treat for people on the Great Plains to enjoy the same spectacle seen by audiences in New York City and San Francisco. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Winter in Spokane, Washington can be frigid, especially for homeless people.
The first night I came here, I was almost frozen to the sidewalk.
But the city's trying something different to help people in need.
It's an amazing thing to witness. We have absolutely every service you can think of. Veterinary services, haircuts, showers, clothing, food banks.
Giving hope to the homeless on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, Bismarck filmmaker Sam Sprinzenatic will join us to discuss his first feature-length documentary, Kindred Creatures. It explores our relationship with animals from several perspectives, like the personalities of animals, conditions for animals raised for food and the impacts of a plant-based diet, animal rescues, and the work of animal sanctuaries. Sprinzenatic's film will be released in late March. We'll talk about it with him tomorrow. We hope you can join us for Main Street. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.